Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. We've replaced Brian Brushwood forever.
Take that, Brian.
Yeah, well, for the length of this podcast, which can feel like forever. So that voice you hear is Mr. Brett. Yeah, 100 million gigawatts, yes.
Gigawatts.
And so basically, if you look at the Earth on an infrared camera, you would see all this energy radiating back out. And the scientists said, well, there's a way that we think now, theoretically, we could build collectors that would collect this energy too. And so the effectively, what we do is you'd have a whole other source of energy.
Oh, wow. So we could recycle the own energy that we give out into the universe.
Yeah, the reflected energy, the light that comes from the sun that then would get bounced off, how to capture all of that, all the heat energy, et cetera, and be a tremendous source of energy. And if you reached your maximum limit with that, you could cover your entire planet with this material. And it would also have a side effect.
Uh-huh.
Your planet would be invisible.
What?
Bum, bum, bum.
It's essentially how to make a stealth planet.
So the way that you would, if you were an alien civilization and you were looking for other planets, but we are to somebody else an alien civilization looking for their planets, the way that we would find them is based on the energy signature that they give off. And if we were able to dampen that, we are essentially putting on the Harry Potter invisibility cloak as we make our way to Zonko's joke shop.
Precisely.
Okay.
I think that was actually the example they used in the paper. So that's would be a side effect. We've talked about, like we mentioned, P-cell previously, which is the cellular technology.
Yes.
Which would be super directed, which would be very efficient. And then now you have this form of energy thing that now that there could be tons of stealth planets out there. Now, we just did a survey, by the way, of the area around our solar system trying to see if there might be a rogue planet.
Yeah.
And we were looking for – we could spot something that was like Neptune-sized or bigger, Saturn-sized or bigger at one distance, Neptune-sized or bigger at a certain distance, and all the way out to like the Oort cloud. And so far we haven't found anything. But if it were a stealth planet, we wouldn't know. And if it were much smaller than that, like Mars-sized, would still be out there.
So
within our own solar system?
I mean, and if you were to look
in the outer limits, yeah.
If you were to look at this from a either-or perspective, that would you completely revolutionize how we think of energy on Earth at the cost of making ourselves invisible to anybody who would want to find us? That's a no-brainer, right? We would take the energy instead of the calling card to the rest of the universe that we are here.
Perhaps. I think that if you reached a certain level of technology and you're seeking energy, you know, efficiency, and second, maybe you are paranoid about, listen, you know, like, hey, we made this and maybe we know there are other people out there. Maybe you do pick up stray radio signals. If a couple other civilizations pick them up from other ones, like, man, you know, these people are 100 light years away and, you know, they're watching I Love Lucy right now, which means they're 100 years more advanced. You know, their own version of that. You know,
yeah.
you could have two civilizations that were close to each other, you know, that within radio distance, that would then say, okay, what do we want to do? Do we want to hide our presence?
Yeah.
You know, or do we announce our presence? And that's the thing to think about is what happens if we see something and then it disappears as if they decided to hide themselves.
Are you sure you weren't just reading Pandora's Star?
Well, it's you know, it's funny as we talk, as I say this out loud, that just came to my mind too.
Yeah.
Was the similarities between that. You know, we've got 20 light years away. We've got, I think it's Gliese is a star system or there are planets that we know that there are planets around. There are multiple planets. There's actually a planet 4.5 light years away. But there's, you know, another planet system where we could have stuff that might be Earth sized or whatever. And, you know, how freaky would that be if all of a sudden we're like, you know what? We can't see this planet anymore.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's assume that we are in a place where we can do more with that information. You know, let's say we have long range space transport, and now we look at the things around us in our universe far more like we look at other countries in terms of their ability to do harm to us and our ability to do harm to them. Is that an act of war? I mean, like, imagine if a country was just, you know, completely off the grid and we couldn't find out exactly where it was, you know, to go after. Like, is that an act of aggression to take that kind of cloaking maneuver?
No, I think that's an act of defense.
I wouldn't necessarily read it as that, because if in the history of animals and the evolution in biology, an animal that cloaks itself is often trying to avoid being preyed upon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that'd be hard. It'd be harder. I'm just saying, if we just had our current technology and we're doing some sort of laser scan thing and we see the signs of, like, there's something here, then now it looks like it's gone and we just got a fragment of a radio transmission, you know, that would be kind of spooky.
Oh, it's insane. I mean, like the it would capture the imagination of the world, right?
So, yeah, that being said, I mean, we don't have anything that captures an entire world's imagination quite like that. Do you think that moment where that planet disappears and we have easy proof that this planet just wiped itself off the face of the universe, as far as we know, do you think that would spark just this mad technological gold rush to try and find a way to communicate with this planet?
Well, that perhaps, but that brings up the question, Brett. Do we say, if we think that, you know, we think there's evidence that they decided to shield themselves or hide themselves, do we take that as evidence that, like, they don't want to talk to us?
Right. But, I mean, how do you tamp down that innate human curiosity to not want to poke it with a stick when it disappears? It's like a little kid with a chameleon throwing it around on all these plaid fabrics just to see what happens.
I mean, we would certainly try to find other ways to identify it, right? I mean, if the way that we have figured out how to see if something is there fails, we would try other ways of doing it.
Mm-hmm. I think if we started to see other ways, it's hard because it comes down to, once you can't see it, you might be able to try to pick up some sort of gravity signatures as it orbits its star. You look for that. You know, if it's a complex system, it becomes harder with a lot of different planets. And if you then sort of see, yeah, we think there's something there, but they're not letting us see it. And the only there's a body there. The only thing we can explain is that it's been cloaked, so to speak. Do you then say, let's send a probe out there?
I mean, right now, Mars is the object of the world's fascination in terms of, you know, planets. It is within a certain degree colonizable. It is part of our folklore. It is a very large target for space exploration. If something like this occurs, you got to figure it is something that we want to figure out. You know, it is maybe the biggest mystery that we would have seen in terms of, like, an active, like active space problems don't really pop up in our modern world. That would be,
well,
one.
If we look for corollaries, when they had the last big typhoon to hit Southeast Asia, one of the regions that we were very concerned about, or rescuers are concerned about, is there was a bunch of little islands there. And on the islands is one of the last totally isolated groups of people. This is a tribe that, to our knowledge, has never had first contact with Western civilization.
Yeah.
They've had contact with tribes that then have had contact with people outside, but these people directly have never had contact with us. And when we sent our helicopters by to go check on them, they ran out of the beach with their spears and threw them at the helicopters.
Yes.
And so our attitude towards these people is, hey, hands off. Just leave them be. Now, we could argue from an individualist point of view how, you know, if you're the inbred offspring of said tribal member and subject to the whatever sort of primitive lifestyle they have, which can involve all sorts of horrific acts, maybe that's not the wisest choice. But our policy as a whole is hands off on these folks.
Yeah.
I feel like we missed a chance with the Mars talk a second ago. Like, I feel like that's a great analogy to throw this blanket over the top of. What if, like, tomorrow Mars disappeared and we don't know why? Are we saying that we wouldn't do everything we can to go out there and try and figure out why Mars went stealth all of a sudden?
Then we go into militarization as fast as we can.
Well, but then that goes back to my first thing. Like if all of a sudden it goes it goes dark, then that's a reason. I mean, if it's not an act of war by whatever leadership we would assume runs Mars, it is certainly a reason for us to, you know, start polishing off the you know, anything that we can to defend ourselves against something.
Sure. Build up a strong defense, but that's different than, do we want to send probes out there? Do we want to go into their space and their you know, go into their solar system and start? And granted, you know,
because if I'm the president, I'm just launching nukes, and I know that they probably
straight
don't get
at Mars.
There. I'm just saying, I'm calling up Elon, and I'm like, dude, you heard this Mars stuff? And he's like, bro, I did. And I'm like, how many nukes can we get on a rocket to hit Mars tomorrow?
Are you kidding me? Right now, you like Mars disappears, and you're like the president of the Intergalactic Federation. You
I'm
just shoot missiles
Earth.
At it.
Yes, I'm president of the United
well,
States,
again, and it's.
You're like, I'm Justin. I send nukes.
Camouflage should be used for offensive or defensive. And there's actually, you know, there's precedent to this too. Like Japan in the 19th century, they decided to seal off their borders to all Westerners.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they said, we don't want to trade. And then Admiral Perry, played by John Wayne in the movie, showed up with a fleet of ships and was like, hey, open up your ports. We want to trade. And.
Oh, man.
And how'd that end?
You can see The Last Samurai starring Tom Cruise.
But that's the move, right? But, like, isn't diplomacy still the first move? You just, like, send – you like, tomorrow we could drop someone in a rocket and send them to Mars. Like, it's not necessarily going to be safe, right? They might not make it alive, but that's probably what we do if Mars disappears, right?
Yeah, all right. So, like, that's going to be like, hey, we're going to send you, Brett, behind enemy lines in Russia – but, you know, we're going to give you asthma. We're going to give you no food supply. You know,
what's Martian for suit? Don't kill the messenger?
Yeah. All right. All right. One more thing on this, and then we can move on to another topic. Let's follow this idea. Mars disappears. Okay. Beyond what we would do in terms of a defensive buildup, what is even our best guess on who is making that call if it's an intelligent entity, and, you know, the idea that maybe it's some sort of natural phenomenon that we just have not seen until now?
I mean, what happens is you'd have your world governments, and then each politician, ours and everybody else, would pick their favorite scientists and put them into a room, and then they would sort of argue for some sort of consensus on what they think is happening.
Yeah.
And you know, they would quickly fall behind a couple theories that they think best supports what they support and what they can deal with. Whether or not that's going to be the reality of what happened, you know, isn't necessarily the case. And that's often what happens when you get big, you know, government scientific inquiries. You know, you're told we need an answer now, so you give them an answer. But sometimes that answer is not going to be the one that you need because the information you need is unavailable. So we'll have an explanation. Will it be the right one?
Man. Will it be the one that results in Justin sending nukes to Mars?
I'm just saying. Boom, 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 boom. Alpha Tango Zulu Foxtrot to Mars.
That's
boom.
Such a terrible idea. I like, so, there's so many reasons
I'm
why that's a terrible
idea. I'm cracking those
codes,
bro, and they're all going to the red planet. Yeah. You think you can hide from me? I don't think so. Well, President Young's administration.
We have the power to destroy almost 100 square miles of Mars. And then, of course, they still have plenty of room to retaliate. And they're also, by the way, capable of making an entire planet disappear.
Oh, that.
So, it was on a Google Hangout with some fellow members of Diamond Club.
Mm-hmm.
And a subject came up. Somebody asked, we were talking to somebody from Michigan and asked, you know, what's interesting in Michigan? Do you have any paranormal stuff or whatever there? And he replied, no, said, no, they did not. And I was curious, Wisconsin, pardon me. And I said, no, that's interesting. I wonder. And so I looked up Wisconsin to find out what kind of mythical animals or legends they have there. And I found one of the most awesome ones I've ever heard before.
Okay.
And I want to, it's not just an animal, not just a mythical creature or some sort of, you know, weird creature. It's like a whole, like there's a town, and I'm trying to find it. It's called Haunchyville.
Oh,
Have you heard of Haunchyville?
I've never heard of Haunchyville, Wisconsin. No.
I've heard of Haunchy Tonks. That's where they do the rock and roll country music, right?
Haunchy Cat, you better get back in the woods.
Located near Mystic Drive in Muskego, Wisconsin.
Okay.
Haunchyville is a mythical village of dwarfs in Waukesha County, Wisconsin. Locals say that within the woods near Muskego, Wisconsin lives a conclave of dwarves whose homes are built to scale and in the woods. In the mythical village is said to live an old albino man who serves as their protector. Legend has it, if trespassers are caught, the unruly dwarves cut their legs from their knees down so they're forced to live like one of them. According to the legend, after the continuous exploitation of a number of circus dwarfs, they revolted against their ringleader. After killing their master, they hanged him in a wooded area after first cutting off his arms and legs. To avoid being arrested or even worse consequences from the circus community, the dwarfs set out to create their own community built exclusively for dwarfs.
This sounds like an easily explored myth.
Well, I mean, it's not crazy, though. I mean, like, you have towns. Like, what's the town in Florida where all the freaks live?
Well, there's Bridgeport in Connecticut.
Davie.
No, Davie, of course. No. No, but there's one. It's in the west coast of Florida, and I can't remember what it
Barnum and Bailey used to, like, summer in Bridgeport, Connecticut. That was a town that was started, specifically for the circus.
Yeah, no, there's another one in Florida where it's, like, they've had, like, reality shows there or whatever that is comprised by, you know, people who are otherwise full-time traveling in circuses and stuff like that. And
yeah, that was where they would winter. I could think of it.
Gibsonton, that's it. Or Gobsonton. It's something like that.
Gibbstown,
that's it. So, I mean, like, that's really not – I mean, of course, we are taking away the murder element of this and the strange albino man who will cut off your arms and legs, but
– No, just your legs, so you're short.
Oh, just your legs, so you can
No arms, too. I'm sorry. My bad.
Yeah, because otherwise you'd have a really unfair advantage in pickup basketball if you were, like, short but you had this crazy wingspan.
You think that gives you an advantage? You have no knees but you have long arms?
I'm just saying. You can put your arms up. You're blocking shots. You're like the Hakeem Olajuwon.
You're falling on your face repeatedly.
Oh, dude. So obviously that part is something that is far-fetched, right?
Well,
but the idea
that a bunch of circus dwarves
would live in a town in Wisconsin, like, is that unreasonable to think?
I don't think so. And in fact, I would even say that it's not super unreasonable that there is, like, enough mayhem for there to be a growing myth of mayhem. Just because, I mean, like, the rules were way laxer, one, in that era, and two, in circuses specifically. Those things were, like, rife with all kinds of shady shenanigans back in the day.
Oh, yeah. I mean... Like so what do we know a time period on when the origins of this were said to come to be, Andrew?
It's not the most well documented, but according to one article, it says there were a lot of circus enclaves in Wisconsin, and when those circuses broke up, they had a lot of little people that had to go somewhere. So it's not entirely impossible to think that at one point, and I'm gonna get to something in a second, but you know, there could have been a little village of just, you know, some trailers or whatever, some dwarf people had set up there for like a winter or two.
And I mean, and then once you get there, how far is it to get to the, like, well, maybe some really brutal, horrific stuff happened there at some point, and then it had this reputation forever?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't even have to get the really brutal stuff. I mean, if you have a bunch of kids who see these dwarfs, they're going to come up with the most messed up, screwed up thing they can come up with. Now,
yeah.
As a side note, you may remember when we first discussed the legend of Monkey Island,
yeah.
And your intrepid explorer here decided to take it upon himself to find the remnants of this lost simian civilization in the heart of Los Angeles.
Also known as to stop on his way to the Togo sandwich shop because the office he was working in was right next to where Monkey Island was supposed to be.
Yes. And I did find remnants of Monkey Island.
You did.
I found concrete structures, embankments, part of it, which would tie back into this wonderful civilization. Well, this wonderful theme park attraction that was probably a horrific place for monkeys to live. But anyhow, having got to the bottom of that, I decided to embark upon an investigation for Haunchyville.
Really?
And yeah, but I decided I'd just do it from, you know, from the comfort of my own place here on computer. Using Google Images on Google Earth.
There we go.
I did a search of the swampland or the area of the land around that part of Wisconsin.
Okay.
Basically going over by, you know, several yards by several yards, trying to find any remnants of it. And I could find no present remnants of Haunchyville. But that's not to say there wasn't things there, which would maybe require some sort of on-the-foot investigation.
We do have people in the chat room that are from Wisconsin that are volunteering to go physically investigate Haunchyville. If you would like to do that, then please go ahead and hit us up on Twitter. We'll coordinate going out there and asking around, because I think that would be really, really fun.
It sounded like you had pretty good coordinates on where Haunchyville was. Is that not true? Like, you know it's basically, like, west of X City?
The road, they say that near this road, they it's, you know, they're pretty specific about.
Huh. See, that's the thing where, like, how do you build a myth about a city when you tell the people where the city is and there's not something there?
It's in woods, Brett.
On a road? Like, I live in the woods on a road. I could still tell you how to get to my house.
But the road ends and then it ends in woods. So, like, down in South Florida, there are parts of South Florida. Like, you look and you see Miami. If you then go west, you're not necessarily right in the Everglades just yet. It gets to be in the sticks. And there are places out there that, like, you know, up until recently, even some places, you know, if you drive down there, you get shot at, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There, way out in there was, you know, that was used to be back in the 30s, was in the 20s and 30s, like Al Capone had a house out there, like, and he would, like, a gambling house, and they would feed people to alligators and stuff. And so you knew that was out there, but you didn't go there.
Yeah.
And this could be that. And also, I mean, like let's even take it beyond any kind of, you know, the physical attributes of the people there. Like, the idea of the circus or traveling performer, like, was, I mean, talk about, like, cloaking a planet. In a pre-internet and pre-mass communication age, you were essentially an anonymous person, right? I mean, like, so much of the life you would build would be your physical reputation amongst people that knew who you were and what you did and the sum total of your actions as they could remember them. If you just travel from town to town, I mean, it is anonymity to the extreme, right?
Well, until you're a dwarf and someone paints that broad brush on every dwarf that they see after hearing a story about you cutting off people's legs.
Well, but even then, who hears, like, let's say you do actually cut off people's legs, right? Unless there are people from the place where you cut off their legs in the other town where you are, who knows? How does that track you? You know, like, nobody can just, you know, it's not like it would be cheap and easy to call your friend, you know, or Snapchat them, or post it on the, you know.
Well, there's still
app.
Lots of travelers around the world that are not circus performers that spread awful stories from town to town. Like, word spreads, and word has always spread. Like, we still had elections.
Not as fast.
No, not as fast, but it gets there. It doesn't have to get there quickly.
Lost legs to dwarves. Stop.
Yeah.
Arms too. Stop.
The infamous.
I'll tell you what. It's a fascinating concept that, like, I mean, who is that police officer that has to go investigate? Let's assume that there's a kernel of this is true, right? And there is a town of by and large peaceful performers that are there, and then all of a sudden there's some sort of brutal murder. Like, and you're the police officer that has to go into the unmarked woodland town to try and find justice for the people.
I could picture a cop walking up there and being like, oh, yeah, yeah, there's a city full of dwarves there. And then he gets back to the bar later on. You're like, so what'd you do? He's like, are you kidding me?
Hashtag,
there's a city full of dwarves there. I beat the hell out.
Hashtag True Detective Season 2.
So one of my favorite, and I've mentioned this, you know, several times on this podcast, but one of my favorite stories is from a friend of mine and actually Justin's, Jack Latona.
Oh, yeah.
Talked about, I think he was on the city council in Fort Lauderdale, and one day he's in his office, and they get a call from this woman, this old woman, and she says, their body's coming out of the ground. There are people coming out of the ground. Like, nobody's been doing nothing about it. Their body's coming out of the ground. And the secretary's like, what do we do? This sounds crazy. Jack's like, yeah, it sounds crazy, but you never know.
I am the city councilman in Fort Lauderdale. We should probably investigate it.
Yeah. Well, she called everybody. Nobody listened to him.
Yeah.
You know? And so she was just trying, she was complaining and saying this. He says, all right, why don't we, you know, have a, you know, police car or something go by there. They send a police car by, and it's these basically these old buildings, like these project type buildings, and it's very low income area. And they go look in the back area and the overgrown grass area, and they start looking along, and sure enough, there are skeletons and bodies half coming out of the ground. It had been a pauper cemetery where they hadn't actually put them in coffins. They just threw them in the ground, and as the rain came in and the mud drained away, the bodies were coming out of the ground.
Good God. That's horrifying.
Yeah. And you think, here's this woman. It's like, hey, listen, there are bodies coming out of the ground.
Yeah.
Could you please describe more fully the situation?
Yeah.
There's bodies coming out of the ground.
You know, like, really, could you help us out here, please?
There's bodies coming out of the ground.
Now, and meanwhile, if it were somebody who is absolutely, you know, like a gunfighter calm and calling there in the most erudite British accent, it would still most accurately be, there are bodies coming out of the ground.
There are dwarves cutting off legs. So you never know. So I think we'll get maybe some of our Wisconsinites out there will go investigate this for us and let us know. And
you're rad. Good luck with your legs.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe pair up. Yeah. Wear stilts. Go out there in stilts. So it'd be
shin guards. Shin guards and knee pads. Come on. Let's stay safe, people.
They'll be like, oh, they'll cut off the stilts or not.
Maybe get some practice in by going to a playground at recess time and beating up as many kids as you can at once.
That seems like a really responsible way to handle this.
You gotta be prepared.
All right. So, gentlemen, do we want to do one more?
Sure. Go ahead.
All right. This is kind of cool. This is more of a technology thing, which is kind of a cool thing, which I thought, and it's a ongoing Microsoft project. Oh, actually, you know what? I think I want to do. I just forgot. Let me do that, and then we'll talk about. Oh, there's so many other things I want to get to. All right. I'm going to do this first. Forget I said that, okay?
Okay.
Forget I brought that up because this is the thing I want to talk about. This was a cool thing that came out on IO9 today explaining one of the reasons why we really want to investigate the moon Europa, right?
Which is what we've talked about before. We spent a lot of time talking about it on this podcast, right?
Europa?
Europa. What wasn't that the idea of –
yeah, the ice.
Yeah, the ice and underwater civilization, how you would keep records underwater.
Yeah, we touched upon that. So Europa's a moon of Jupiter. But the thing that made it particularly interesting for me, which sold it for me, was an infographic which explained that Europa has more water than Earth does.
What?
Europa has more water than Earth does.
What? Because it's all frozen, though, right? Or I guess...
Well, can't be frozen, Brett? What do you know?
Yeah.
So we know that there is likely just large swaths of ice, but we have no idea how deep those reservoirs go and how much water there is.
Yeah, how do you calculate that?
There are fissures on the surface of it that look where the ice is broken through and then liquid waters come through the top and then refroze. So there is very likely, there is at some stages, there's liquid. There's very likely a liquid ocean underneath the ice of Europa.
Hmm.
So
how big is Europa relative to Earth?
What's that?
How big is Europa relative to Earth?
Europa is, I think, smaller than the moon. Or is it? No, it's bigger than the moon. Let's see how big Europa is. Good question. Europa to moon. I'm going to go to Wolfram Alpha and do that. Entertain yourselves.
Mooncat suggests that Europa is about the same size as the moon. And to have more water than Earth, then, like, by percentage, I wonder, you know, how much of that, you know, just landmass as a whole is completely, reservoirs and submerged. I mean, I guess that's the crazy. Of all we know of it is ice, then we have no idea how deep that ice runs and in what patterns. And, like, if even the way that, well, I guess we know enough about how planets are made to kind of know generally how it's constructed, right?
Does it have to have a solid core? Well, I mean, clearly it doesn't have to have a solid core, but, like, how deep is it possible for water to go before it can't just be a giant drop of water floating in space?
Sure.
No, it could certainly have a core, because there are certainly going to be materials and things like that, the heavier elements and stuff that would be there. So it's not, we're pretty sure it's not solid water, because I think that we'd be able to figure out the mass from that and what it would expect it to weigh versus the size. But, you know, if you look at the Earth and how thin, you know, Europa certainly wouldn't be solid water all the way through. If you look at the Earth and then like how, you know, like I gave the example, like, oh, if the Earth was a basketball, the water on the surface of it would be, I don't know how thick, but they use sort of those examples. But anyhow, it's a fascinating thing to think about, that the biggest ocean in our solar system is not our ocean. It's on Europa.
Wow. So then how far are we away if we add up all the timeline projections of the technology from being able to mine Europa for water if we wanted to?
Well, there are a lot of easier places to get water. You know, the asteroid Ceres has water on it.
Yeah.
And so if you start looking at other places there that have even less gravity, there are other places. But the curious thing we want to do is we want to be able to land a probe, drill through the ice, and go see what's in the ocean there.
What's going on there, yeah.
Because there's some scientists who think that, like, we might, you know, it might be you drill through the ice, you pop through there, and some little thing looks right back at you.
Yeah. That is wild.
That's super crazy.
So.
Especially if we piss it off and it tried to cloak itself with ice, and now it's just an angry jellyfish creature with a rocket.
So would Europa be a colonization point? Like, I mean, is it something that we could look to, like, is the availability of water there make it more likely to be habitable than something like Mars, where we would have to import it?
No, we don't have to import water to Mars. Mars has water.
Oh, Mars has water. Okay, never mind.
Yeah, Mars has, like, I forget the percentage, but, like, one you know, cubic foot of dirt on Mars has, like, 1% or 2% of water.
Oh, okay, okay.
That's Mars, like these other places, like keep looking more and more attractive now because of the prevalence of water. We used to think, you know, back when I was a kid, there was the point where you looked at, what makes Earth special? Like, we got this water and we don't see water anywhere else. And then now we look like, holy crap, there's a lot of water.
There's water everywhere.
There's more water. I got more water on Europa than on here.
Yeah.
Turns out hydrogen and oxygen are kind of common.
Who would have thought?
Kaya was pointing out, and yes, I am a big fat idiot. Every place we have been has water, which, I mean, at this point, like in terms of the grand list of space explorations, it's, you know, not that many places that we've been that has water. I mean, I guess in terms of probes and everything.
But as to, I mean, you know, you'd try to colonize Mars. I'm a big believer that we just, you know, why not live on asteroids? But then when it comes to Europa, you would build, you know, that might become like Antarctica, building research stations and trying to study what's underneath, et cetera. It's pointed out there in the chat room. Somebody pointed out there's a thing on the movie out, Europa Report, which Brian talked about. It's a found footage film, so it'll take me a while to get through it.
We will get through it. It just, you know, it's going to take a little time.
So anyhow, that's just think about it. The more water on Europa than Earth, the biggest ocean in our solar system we know of, ain't on Earth.
That is buck wild. And so when did that come out? How do they figure that out?
Or is that
just a known
thing? It's as we send probes by, we look at the surface, we are able to analyze what it is, its mass, et cetera.
What's the atmosphere of Europa like?
Somebody in the chat room said there's no water on the moon. That's not correct. There is water on the moon too.
And Whitey's on the moon.
Yeah. So there's like water everywhere. And you know what? It's very cool. Here's the thing to think about. There is actually probably ice and snow on Mercury.
Whoa.
What?
You're like, Andrew, that's insane.
It's so close to the sun.
But the thing is that Mercury is essentially, you know, what you call like it has its – the way that it moves around the sun, there's craters and there's parts of it that do not see sunlight. And it's like in the shadows of those craters, et cetera, it gets dramatically cold. And you would have ice form.
That's insane.
So could we build cliff dwellings like halfway up that crater to moderate temperature?
If we would like to live on Mercury, which seems like a fairly poor idea.
Hey, it's possible, right? I mean, it's a poor idea to live anywhere that isn't Earth after we've spent billions of years being perfectly suited to this one planet.
Especially with these home prices, am I right?
When I was a kid, I remember picking up this book about colonizing space, and this was, you know, written in the 70s, and it was beautifully illustrated. It was probably by somebody who was very high at the time. And one of the cool places we could live on, they described, was what about on a sunspot? and they actually had this colony like on a sunspot, right? And he saw the really, really hot sun all around, but then the sunspot looked like San Diego, you know, people paragliding and stuff. And as a kid, I'm like, this doesn't seem like a really good idea for a lot of reasons. And one, a sunspot's actually still like a couple million degrees, probably
sure.
One. You know, because you're still, guess what, next to the goddamn sun.
Yeah, yeah. There is that part about being on the sun, you know.
Yeah. And then there's like, oh, the huge crushing gravity. You know, there's that too.
So, pushing you into the flaming hell that is the sun.
And then we talk about the radiation. So it's
just
a dumb idea. It was a beautiful picture, though.
Oh, dude. Very high. Very high, so, brother.
Thing I mentioned before, I just touched upon, it was kind of cool, is Microsoft has revealed one of the concepts, some more stuff for an idea they have for how to maximize the space around your living room, for example. And they call it, we find the example of what they describe it as here. Basically what it is, it's a projection system that would project images onto the walls around your TV, everywhere else. And they showed a concept of this where they were using it to project, let's say, the internet. So you could be sitting there watching television and then look up and see, they call it surround web, Microsoft's plan to cloak your living room with internet. And they show, like, you know, somebody's playing, looks like Forza Motorsport or whatever. And then above it is their TV, above their TV projected on the wall are some stats, to the left, some video and everything else. And it's an interesting idea we've talked about before, you know, turning everything else into some sort of surface, some sort of display.
Yeah. Now, in the past, it seems like you've been not exactly bullish on the projection idea, though, right? Like that there would be other ways that we could do stuff that wasn't a projection necessarily.
Well, I'm big on projection. I think that the next step is going to be as it becomes easier to, you know, project large amounts of light and keep things cool. As we get cooler LEDs, et cetera, I think that you're going to see, and it becomes dirt cheap, is you're going to see devices that are the size of Apple TVs or whatever that are projectors, and you just start projecting your images instead of buying big flat screens.
Yeah.
And as you start projecting, and like what Microsoft's doing here is saying, hey, let's look at a room, look at all the flat spaces, and project onto there.
That's what we do at my house already, and it's great. Like, we, in the living room, just have an 8-foot whiteboard and a projector mount on the ceiling, and it frees up so much space. Granted, we, like, don't get to watch cable TV or anything, but we can still stream, like, Hulu and Netflix and stuff on it. And the rest of the time, it's an awesome whiteboard that ideas get to go on.
That's very cool. See, Brett's living in the future, guys. That's why he's here. But you start thinking about you when you have enough projector where you could project onto any surface.
Yeah.
In your place. And I think
any light colored surface at that point, like your design styles are being dictated by whether or not you want to use a wall as a projector or a projection screen.
Yeah. But you could start projecting anything. And I think that, one of the things that we talked about before, eventually you get to just like straight projecting right into the eyeball. But
yeah.
The intermediary technology is really cheap video projectors and projecting all around. And so their idea is that like the image quality isn't as good as looking at your TV, your blacks aren't true blacks, et cetera. But for other kinds of bits of data, like following your Twitter stream. I mean, this looks like a nightmare to me. I'll be honest. You know, watching TV and having all this other data pop up. It might be fun for a video game, but I don't really want to watch Game of Thrones.
No. And that's – it's funny because I thought about that a lot when I was using Google Glass. That like, all right, now let's look at the idea that there is a small projection system that I can have in my face at all times. The next step, and I don't think this is necessarily a fault to Google Glass. It just happens to be the first widely publicly available version of this that has gained a degree of popularity. What is the information that we want there? And I think like this is a very good example. What do we – I mean like what would be more popular? Live updating tech stuff the way that we look at the internet on our laptops and on our phones and on our iPads, or just a updating wallpaper that just kind of looked good and you enjoyed and made you happy when you looked at it. I think that there's an infinite amount of information that we can project there, and it's not the ultimate stopping place for that will not be what we think of the internet as, like the news gathering element.
I would love to do this podcast with a video projection and sit on my couch and talk to you guys.
Yeah.
And I think we start looking at what the smartphone showed us what we could pull away from the internet and put into our pocket. The tablet said, what can we pull away from our computer and, you know, our laptops and put in front of us. And then as we try to pull everything away from the desktop into other places, and that doesn't mean necessarily turning the TV into your computer. It can mean looking at other areas, other ways of using these technologies.
That's a good way to look at it. I mean, the first step to like internet content was putting the TV on your desktop, but that is not a place you want to absorb TV from.
No.
And we do need a better way to move away from that.
Sure. That's fascinating.
Speaking of which, and maybe you guys saw this, you know, for our listeners out there, made up for the Oculus Rift is a new technology, or it's a new way approach towards trying to make a much better 3D type of goggle. And the problem that's been in the past for having strapping on goggles and seeing 3D is resolution's been crappy, field of view's been very small, and tracking was bad. And that's why if you played some of these things, they were too slow to track, and it just didn't feel really good. And as we've had smartphones have evolved, and now you have smartphone screens with approaching 4K displays, and you have on a chip sensors can track your head better, and we're getting much faster computing. The 3D goggles, the strapping them on and being in virtual reality has gotten much, much better. And Oculus Rift is one of the companies leading the way in developing really, really cool high-end 3D. And you guys heard about the demo that was done at South By?
Yeah, it was actually the line was wrapping around the block, literally half a block away from the Diamond Club party yesterday. It was a huge, huge line for the demo, and we were trying to get the party set up. But otherwise, I would have waited in line. I don't know if it was badge only, but like, yeah, no, we saw everybody waiting in line for it.
I didn't hear about how it went, though.
You think about what would be really cool. You already have this technology, and right now what it's good for is you can strap these things on. One of the demos they have people say is great. You can see a movie theater, and it feels like you're in a giant movie theater. Again, you just put these goggles on, but you feel like you're in a big, huge cavernous theater. Another example is, you know, what could you do? They have demos where you step into rooms, you step into there. Well, HBO and Game of Thrones came along and said, hey, this sounds like a fun thing. And so, Justin, do you know the walkthrough on what happens?
I do not. I heard, I mean, Game of Thrones is obviously a very popular thing with the nerd set that is right now taking over Austin. And between this and the Game of Thrones rap mixtape, which was released on Friday, HBO is clearly gearing up as True Detective comes to an end. They are gearing up for the impending Game of Thrones scene.
But right. But do you know what they did with the Oculus?
No, Rift? I do not.
Okay. Apparently what you do is you go step into the elevator in the Great Wall, the wall that separates, you know, the north.
Uh-huh.
You get into the elevator, you put on the goggles, and it simulates that you're taking the elevator to the top of the wall, and then it opens up, and you look out onto the wall, and you can see the vast snowy landscapes. And they apparently have wind blowing at you, and they make it cold, and they add all this other sensory information so you feel like you're looking at the frontier.
Oh, crazy. I wonder how many people try to pee off it, like Tyrion.
I was at the launch festival a couple of weeks ago, and they had like this this omnidirectional treadmill that you stand in the middle of with some goggles on, and then you can walk in any direction, and it tracks your body movement and moves you through the video game that you're playing without you moving anywhere.
I think
it was
a Skyrim mod. Yeah, I think I remember seeing a thing with that.
Yeah, it was a shooter.
Oh, was it a shooter? Okay. Yeah. I know that there is a Skyrim mod for that same system. That is crazy, though. So, I mean, like, have you read – I haven't read any of the reviews. Have people been positive on it?
Oh, yeah. They say this experience was great. That part of what helped it was adding these other effects to it.
Yeah.
It's a very, very stunning – it's one of the most stunning demonstrations of it yet. And this is – you know, we're – not going to see we're not going to see the ideal version of this probably in production this year, but probably by next year, somebody like Sony and other companies are working on it. We're very, very soon going to be seeing the next big thing is going to be these 3D goggles. They're going to be the really good ones with really good tracking. There'll be some crappy ones out there that people will try to race to market with that won't track as well, and that might kill some of the enthusiasm, but when the really good next gen ones come out that are like that you put on, you don't get nauseous and are super, super realistic, that's going to be the next big, you know, innovation in hardware.
So you are bullish on VR. Because VR has been a field that a lot of people have been bullish on for a lot of years, and it has always kind of been the thing that is barely out of reach, if not very out of reach.
You have – the thing is that, like, in technology, you sometimes need certain things to fall in place for the next thing to happen. And, you know, I had a Nintendo Virtual Boy back in the 90s.
I rented one.
And I was always fascinated with this. But the problem you had before is you had your three biggest problems were, one, resolution. How quality of a screen can you put in front of your eyes? And when you're this close to an image, you know, I'm just holding my fingers out there, you're going to see the resolution lines. You're going to feel like you're looking at video.
Yeah.
That's problem number one. Problem number two is going to come down to speed. How fast can you update it? You know, send that signal through there and keep that thing going. How fast can you update if you move your head to the left or the right? Can you keep that signal? The third problem comes into tracking. How do you track where the head is moving? Now, you know, every average smartphone device has a super high resolution screen.
Yeah.
It's got motion sensors inside of there that are very, very good at tracking, and it's got a super fast processor. So
let's say that those are the three biggest problems, though we don't necessarily know that those are the only three big problems, though. I think the real test is, like, how important those added sensory perceptions are to the experience. Like, if it turns out that we're looking out through a fake window, and that might not even be compelling, even if it's perfect.
Well, I guess, Brett, I'm talking about in comparison to, like, video games as they are. To why would you want to strap this on your head to go play Halo versus sit in front of your computer and play Halo?
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, the computer is the better experience because of, you don't have the lag time, those other issues. Once you say, okay, we satisfied that, for many people, this becomes a more attractive way to play that.
Especially if it gives you greater control of the game, which is where you see the divide between PC gaming and console gaming. If all things are equal, people just prefer the idea of a keyboard and a mouse to a control pad.
Well, that's interesting,
when does this become a superior form of entertainment to other forms of entertainment? That's a good question. You know, do you want to watch movies like this? You know, does it have to go to a next level and have the other experiences you talked about? That I don't know.
I think the interesting thing about that is that the reason people play the games on the PC still is because it doesn't mirror the world or model the world at all. You can do things that you wouldn't be able to do in the real world. And that same analog we see with each new iteration of, like, input controls for computers. We went from a keyboard to a mouse. The mouse is not more efficient than keystrokes. If you're trying to do things quickly, you're going to go back to learning keystrokes. And the same goes with, like, voice controls now. Like, yeah, you can use Siri, but 9 times out of 10, you can do it faster some other way.
You're talking about input methods versus how you output. And
we're always trying
to increase frame rate. We're always trying to increase the size of displays. We're always striving towards that. When we do, you know, first-person shooters and you move around, you track around, we're always trying to improve all of those aspects to it.
Right, but if you're using the goggles to track around, then the goggle is an input method. And is that a better input method than being able to, like,
tap
the left arrow?
No, but that's a problem. That's the still big question, is what are you going to use for an input? Maybe you still have a controller in your hand. Maybe you put a gun in your hand. Maybe you use some sort of leap motion or Kinect type thing to see what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe we put you on the treadmill. And I think that when you have the really good VR just in itself, the really good, you feel like you're sipping inside of a movie theater, that is going to be a big step.
Yeah. I mean, it'll definitely be a big, interesting step. I'm curious to see whether or not it actually, like, pays off as a mass market thing.
Well, I mean, if you look at, I mean, where consoles are now, it's hard to get really bullish about where the console market is going to be over the next 10 years. I mean, there's a reason why they're all trying to build in, you know, TiVos and cable, pass-through options and stuff like that. And it's because they think that that's where they will survive instead of just people buying video games on there and playing them. If that's the case, and games themselves are only becoming more popular as they are put in more and more people's hands, and we have a collective global freakout over things like Flappy Birds not being around anymore, who's to say that a new super compelling way to interact with them will not be the next big thing? My only hesitation is via, you know, that idea, the idea of a virtual reality experience as one that is, you know, like, if not haunted, fraught with peril.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
that's what you agreed with, that it's probably haunted and fraught with peril? We just agreed that Lawnmower Man is the biggest threat to VR?
I think that, like, you know, like the trying to make an electric, a good electric car. You couldn't make a good electric car until you did, you solved a couple market problems. Right. You know, one, don't try to make a cheap one, address the sports market. And two, you know, laptop batteries, you know, the battery problem. That was the biggest problem. You couldn't make an electric car that go anywhere because you couldn't have a battery that was efficient enough. But billions of dollars spent on cell phones and laptops later, you know, now the market price for these batteries was, you know, one, they're available, and two, cheap enough that you could put the, you know, make an electric car. And, you know, these are you need certain technological advancements driven by other markets. And I think we're in a position where that's happened.
Well, that's a good analog, too, because I feel like for me to want to own VR goggles or for it to be mass market at all, it has to be so cheap that it's the kind of thing that you might use. It has to be power glove level. We're like, all right, well, I have this thing sitting around here and maybe I'll use it once in a while.
Yeah, well, but it has to be
that price point, not that usage level necessarily.
You said use two for you to want it or for it to be or mass market. I don't own a game console. I don't own a game console that was made in the last 6 years.
Right.
You know,
neither do
so I.
I
don't, you know, I wouldn't describe it as just mass market. What's that?
I said aside from your iPhone.
Yeah, which is not a, you know, I would say is a game console. But yeah, I think that's, you know, as far as, but what can be big, but you look at the success of a game like Minecraft, and then you start thinking when you have a different kind of interaction taking place with games or narratives. So
it will be interesting to see, because that would be dope if it's great. I think there's a reason why we want it all to happen.
Yeah.
And the desire for it has caused so many false starts.
And we've known for a while the biggest problems was kind of resolution and latency, and those are things that are being directly addressed. And that's going to be the interesting thing to see what happens. And the cost effectiveness of these things is, you know, these panels are a lot cheaper. And, you know, you look at what you look at the high-tech stuff coming out on a Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing. But people are able to go build there. So, anyhow, let's move to picks.
Yes.
Now's the time where we pick things. Shall go
mostly my nose.
Do you have any on the top of your head? Or
now I'm reading or listening to Ghostwritten by David Mitchell. Have you guys checked that out yet?
No, what is it?
So the guy that wrote Cloud Atlas, which I was very fond of. This is Ghostwritten, an earlier work that is along the same lines. It has a lot of different plot lines that I assume intermix eventually. But the first storyline is all about this guy who is part of a a doomsday cult, kind of. But he is so deep in it that he doesn't realize he's part of a doomsday cult. He's very sold on the concept that he's the only one living the righteous life.
Mm-hmm.
And that alone was a very compelling plot line, just to hear someone trying to explain to the rest of the world why his way is better and he should be allowed to murder people.
Hmm. Awesome. I never read Cloud Atlas, but you were huge, a huge fan of that.
A big fan of the audiobook especially was really well done, because it's six different characters with six different storylines, and so they use six different narrators because it's all in the
great.
First person.
I love it when they do that.
Yeah. And this, actually, that is an important point about this version of the book, is they have a British narrator, but the main characters are all Japanese. And that was a very weird disconnect for a long time.
Are they doing the Japanese voice, or is it
no,
a British voice?
No, it's all like, I have a very good idea. And you're like, I don't think the Japanese say idea.
I speak as my father spoke in Tokyo. Andrew, what are you looking at?
All right, me? Fine. All right. My pick is, I just saw this last night and I enjoyed it, and that is Hotel of Budapest.
The Grand Budapest Hotel?
Grand Budapest Hotel. I kept thinking of the exotic Marigold Hotel. I couldn't get that out of my head. Grand Budapest Hotel, as it's better known as.
I can't wait to check that out. Were there any high points that are spoiler-free?
I think that it's one of the things. Okay, I'll tell you about this. Like, I have my favorite Wes Anderson films, you know, and this is – I like this a lot. It's not up there. It's not, you know, it's a very, very good. Ralph Fiennes is fantastic.
What are your top two?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Give us your top two, because that can be a little bit divisive, even amongst Wes Anderson fans on what the champ is.
So, but if I do that, I'm only going to divide things even more.
Well, but just so people have a sense of
okay,
where you're
like,
at.
I would say that, like, I love, like, there's always going to be a place in my heart for Tannenbaums, always going to be a place in my heart for Rushmore. And Life Aquatic is one of those things that I don't think I've watched that movie enough.
Wow, that might actually be my least favorite Wes Anderson movie.
Life Aquatic. Yeah, that's not high on mine. But
did you see how I qualified that?
You did.
No. It's great. Okay, it is divisive.
There's things I like.
I don't fault you for liking the movie.
There's like I think there might be more to it, but anyhow. That's my point. It's like there's a lot I like about it, but I don't know. Moonrise Kingdom, I love.
That is my favorite, I think.
What's that?
I think that's my favorite of the West.
Yeah,
Anderson
that may
movies.
Be my favorite too. I mean, that is just absolute pure joy all the way through. I think it's probably Moonrise Kingdom. But anyhow, but I said these things are complicated things.
A little lingering on the shots of the girl. Yeah. In Moonrise
but
Kingdom.
So I thought Ralph Fiennes is fantastic. What happens in this movie? The problem in this movie, though, is you see some of your beloved people, actors and who've been in other movies by him, or people in general. They're there, and then they're not there, and then you don't get them again.
Oh.
You know, or there's not a resolution or something to it in some respects.
That you feel if you were remaking it as Wes Anderson, would you? You personally, I guess, not as Wes Anderson, would you prefer to cast an unknown in those roles?
No, I just think that I would have had maybe not had those roles existed.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Or another scene or two with them to give.
But you kind of have to go one way or another, and especially because some of these people are beloved amongst the Wes Anderson universe, it's hard to. And I haven't seen the movie; I have no idea. But it would be hard if Bill Murray shows up for one scene and then his storyline is left hanging, even though he's made this impression.
Yes.
Okay.
That's good. I can't wait to see it.
Because part of it's like when you watch the trailers for like, oh, this will be great. This will be great. And then you like, oh, I saw all of that. You know, that person's.
Yeah.
But it's a great movie, though. Again, Ralph Fiennes is fantastic. This character's great. It's very, very much worth seeing. So that's my pick.
Oh, man.
The Motel Budapest.
The Motel Exotic Mary Budapest in 3D. I have a bit of a different pick. I've been talking a lot, both with Brett and a few other people, about nonfiction, both books and films and documentaries. And it kind of started when I watched a film that was very, very popular. It's on Netflix, called Blackfish. Now, Blackfish is a movie about the killer whales at SeaWorld, and it is safe to say I have never seen anybody go as hard against SeaWorld as this movie does. It is a absolute hit piece on SeaWorld.
Harder against SeaWorld than the average 13-year-old's Floridian boy?
Yes, I think so. I guess here's my point. I think that they cut a lot of corners, and I think the movie was something other than what it really, really wanted to be, which was they don't agree with animals being in captivity. That the makers of the film and the premise that they go through is one that informs their belief that they do not want animals not in the wild. And to put them in display for humanity's benefit, even if it's entertainment or scientifically, is cruel and unusual toward the animals. And like I think if that's their opinion, that's their opinion. But they created this whole other narrative that by objective fact-checking is a bit spotty, and maybe they went through things that were a little bit misleading to kind of get them there because they wanted to tell this other thing with the underlying point being maybe we shouldn't have animals in zoos or at SeaWorld at all. And it really made me think about where is the acceptable line for people, because I think we all three of us enjoy nonfiction programming of both books and documentaries and stuff like that. Where is the line for us in terms of you've told a great narrative, I've enjoyed that story, but you have shaved off too much of the facts that it is now a funhouse mirror distortion of what we can generally assume really happened? Like, what is that line for you?
I've moved away from, you know, groups or movements that I support when I see that a lot of the people in them embrace polemics and things that are not as fact-based and shave those corners, because that frustrates me. Because if you can't find truth in your own position, you're not qualified to point out the failures in others. And that's a thing that bothers me considerably. And I have a lot of problem with documentaries, because a lot of times people are like, oh, you should see this documentary. And it's like, and I get frustrated because it's like, first 5 minutes in, they did these three things, which, you know, maybe the overall theme I agree with, but these three things are distorting it. And they're, like you said, using the term shaving things off. And it frustrates me. I almost sent you a thing today, an LA Times piece about this researcher who studies, you know, ignorance, and then they give these examples of how people perpetuate ignorance, and it was the most politically agenda-based article, you know, you could imagine, because of all the assumptions they made, like, well, of course these people are wrong, and of course these people are wrong, and it's because these people are trying to feed this ignorance, and it's like, wow, check your own biases.
Yeah.
So, drives me nuts.
But there is, part of it is stakes, right? Like, if, you know, there have been, I think, legitimate criticisms of people, of some of my favorite nonfiction writers to read, including in what we were talking about earlier this weekend, like Malcolm Gladwell and Michael Lewis, that they are people that, you know, can mold facts to fit a narrative that they have. And yet it doesn't tremendously bother me when he's, you know, when Michael Lewis in Moneyball kind of ignores the fact that the Oakland A's had an amazing, if not legendary, pitching staff, which was a lot of the reason why they were good, and not necessarily the bargain basement first baseman that they were able to find. So it doesn't really bother me all that much. There are other things of value that I can take from it. When I watch The King of Kong, King of Kong, by the available facts, shows that there was a lot of that movie that is brilliant and amazing to watch and super fun that did not happen chronologically, that they changed things to make them more dramatic so the movie itself can be more enjoyable. And that doesn't really bother me because, again, we are talking about a King Kong video game record. So I think part of it is it maybe the things that we hold dear, that line is tougher for us to deal with?
I think I think that it's in the things we tend to hold dear often can be our opinions and our views on the world. And that certainly is very, very frustrating. And it's a, you know, anytime somebody suggests a documentary to me, you know, it is frustrating because it's just this, you know, the reason that you're so impassioned by this is because it appealed to you emotionally, not because it appealed to you rationally. Mm-hmm. It used emotion to make you think that these certain things are true, and some of which may be, but ultimately you're recommending it because you were moved on an emotional level, not a logical level.
Well, I would recommend people seeing Blackfish if even just to watch it for the idea of watch it from the creator's perspective. And for me, I found it very interesting, understanding that it was a movie that was fraught with a lot of criticism, including, I think if you just search Blackfish on Google, SeaWorld's sponsored rebuttal, which is a fairly comprehensive minute-by-minute look at what they believe to be, and I think make a fairly compelling case as distortions in the film, pops up there. Just understand from a creator's perspective, you know, what is there, what do you believe, and what do you what are statements that are made that are not untrue and yet not exactly what you might be led to believe?
Well, I would think that, I mean, that's a great point, is that I think that it's the responsible thing for a thinking person to do when you watch something like this and it moves you and you want to tell people about, go look at the criticisms and the rebuttals. If you go tell other people, check this out without having looked at it, you're not being responsible. And that's a very frustrating thing, is that somebody says, oh, did you see this? And you go, did you see the counterpoint? And maybe the counterpoint was invalidated, but they get this no. And it's like, you only know one side of it. And the documentary does this idea of pretending to show you both sides or all the facts, but they don't. And there are things that I love and I support, but I'm like, go look at this, then go look at the criticism of this.
Yeah. And how about this? How about a documentary on SeaWorld sucks and it's boring? And I always used to hate having to go there instead of a real theme park in Orlando.
Directed by a 13-year-old boy from Florida.
It's a 31-year-old boy from Florida.
Would you remember, was it Ocean World?
Ocean World. Where was Ocean World?
That was in Fort Lauderdale. That's where the Art Institute campus is now.
Oh, really? Yeah. No. I was always more the Seaquarium was the only one that was really.
So they had Ocean World there, right? And like then when they closed down, Ocean World was really sad and broken down. It was busted up. And then when they cleared out Ocean World, the developers go and then they start digging up the ground and they start finding dolphin bodies and all these.
Oh my God!
Like, wow, they seem to have lost quite a few.
the dolphins are coming out of the ground.
Oh, yes. I mean, they didn't have a shark tank. They would just dice them up and fed them to them.
I'll tell you what. I kind of feel like if the documentary was just animals shouldn't be in zoos, then like, okay, fine. Like, I can get somebody saying that. Like, that is a point of view that I don't think is necessarily invalid. I don't really know enough to have a point of view on it. But, like, I feel like that was – but what frustrated me more than anything was just say what you mean, man. Like, just say what you mean. Yeah. You mean that you hate animals in zoos. And you mean that it really bothers you that these animals are in SeaWorld at all. And it's not necessarily that this – you know, that you're trying to demonstrate negligence on the part of SeaWorld. Your biggest sin in their biggest sin in your eyes is that they exist at all. And if that's your point, then just make that point. And also, it is very beneficial to look at exactly what people say and exactly what is insinuating and exactly what they have attempted to prove, as we have learned today by reading the cover story of Newsweek.
It seems like that goes right back to the polemics that Andrew doesn't like. It's like that was the point they wanted to make in the film, and they couldn't make their own point, so they found a story that like closely mirrors that point.
Well, and you can't sell that point. Selling the animal shouldn't be in zoos point to CNN is harder than selling the we have uncovered a pattern of corruption that has led to death. That's speaking. You know, that is the speaking truth to power narrative that sells to CNN. The fact that you hate the fact that zoos exist does not qualify as newsworthy.
There you have it. Last minute housekeeping. When this goes up out on weirdthings.com and Justin tweets it and I tweet it and Brit tweets it, we'd love for you guys to maybe tell your friends. Tell your friends about Weird Things.
Absolutely. Go ahead. Let's make this week Tell Your Friends About Weird Things Week. Go ahead.
This is actually by far my favorite podcast on the interwebs.
There we go. And you could be this episode. It could be your favorite episode ever. The beautiful thing about Weird Things is that by and large, it's an evergreen podcast. It's not really shackled to the stories of the day necessarily. So pick your favorite one and tell a friend about it on Twitter. And make sure you include @WeirdThingsCom in there. And maybe we'll shout out some of the folks that did that next week.
Yeah, and maybe I just want to check something here. I realize I want to look something up here. I'm doing my research, not hunchy research,
okay,
as much as I'd like to be doing. And I would seriously, if anybody out there, and I understand that is a swamp, but if anybody out there wants to go out there and go look for said hunchies, we'd love to find out. We take no responsibility of that.
In fact, we're going to have you sign a waiver.
Yeah, we can't be accountable for that. So I believe, again, can't get through a Weird Things episode without mentioning, you know what, next Sunday, I think, is the launch.
Mm-hmm.
March 16th, I think, is SpaceX is going to be launching their Dragon for the ISS resupply mission. And this is going to be the Dragon, or the Falcon rocket, rather. The Falcon is going to have landing legs on it.
Yeah.
But they're not using it, right? They're
just they are. Just to land in the ocean.
Yeah, they're going to try to pick a point. They're going to pick a point in the ocean and try to hit it at the kind of velocity that they would need to land, which is going to be super awesome. And it's really sad that they're not going to lead private space exploration, or private entities won't be leading space exploration in the future. Also, watch Cosmos on Fox.
Yeah, unrelated. But yeah, so maybe I'll check the time so that maybe we do a Weird Things, a live cast.
I'd love to. I'd love to do that. That would be super fun. And I think maybe we could even rope in – I remember we did the launch thing with Merritt last time. I'm sure Merritt would love to maybe pitch in and help us with that. We could have Brian run CENTCOM here, and we can do some dope coverage. That would be great.
Yeah. Again, a rocket designed to land back on the pad, kids.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Freak show. Absolutely.
That's game changer. That's a Kitty Hawk moment.
Yeah. All right. I'm not going to say all the snipey things that I would have otherwise said. It's
I'll say it's been weird, which I just did, and then now we can say the snipey things.